Why do you eat what you eat? You may think the decisions you make about the food you put in your mouth are entirely yours, but according to Brian Wansink, you're wrong, and he can prove it. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Brian Wansink is the director of the Food and Brand Lab at Cornell University and the author of Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. His research has revealed that our diet is influenced every day by an almost endless and often invisible list of factors. We'll talk about how environment, proximity, company, and so many other things influence our behavior and how we can use this information to mindlessly eat less. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Every day, the decisions that we make about the food we eat are influenced by factors beyond our control. Brian Wansink is the director of the Food and Brand Lab at Cornell University and the author of the book Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. The research he's done shows many of the ways we're manipulated by our environment, our friends, and even the appearance or the idea of the food that we eat. He is here in the studio with me. Hello, Brian.
Oh, hello, Charity. It's great to be with you.
Well, it's so nice to have you here. And you connect your interest in consumer psychology and how our diets work to an event back in, what, 1968 when you were visiting your aunt and uncle's farm in Correctionville, Iowa.
That's right.
Tell me about the conversation you had with your uncle.
Well, you know, it's amazing. I grew up in Sioux City, Iowa. And back then, everything revolved around food. I mean, we sold tomatoes and cucumbers door to door, and it was amazing that you could see the exact same household across the street from each other. One of them would buy everything you had in the wagon, and the other house would look at you like you were selling kryptonite or something. And it became so interesting to me, what exactly is it that causes some people to really like food and other people to just think the same stuff is terrible? And it sort of spun me off in this direction of just looking at the psychology behind eating behavior.
And your uncle said to you that he'd be taking you to the movie theater if people ate more corn.
What ended up happening was every summer we'd culminate the summer by going to a movie theater, by seeing a movie in Holstein, Iowa. And one summer we didn't go, and I asked my uncle if we were going to go. And he said, well, we would if people ate more corn, which is a very shrewd way of saying corn prices are low. We don't have the money. So at that point, it's like, well, what can we do to make sure that people eat more food so that I get to see movies every summer?
So that's really your driving motivation here is trips to the movie theater.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, when you started to look into consumer psychology, I mean, I think a lot of us think about marketing. We think about advertisements and how advertisements influence us. But that's really just the beginning of the story, isn't it?
Yeah, we like to point at advertisements and like to say, yeah, you know, the reason I'm eating all this food is because I saw an ad for Burger King once, whatever. No, it has a whole lot less to do with it than a lot of the things around us. I mean, we end up finding that simply what the person's doing next to you influences about 44% of how much food you'll serve yourself. We find that the distance that a serving bowl is away from you ends up influencing how much you eat. You know, we even found in one study we did something with a bunch of office workers. We either put candy dishes on their desk or we put them 6 feet away from their desk. And simply having this candy dish on your desk led people to eat about 11 candies a day, which is twice as much as if it's just 6 feet away, which is probably about 120 calories more. And simply moving something gives you so much more control than kind of pointing at a sign saying, it's that billboard that made it's making me fat. No, it's partly where you put the candy dish. It's the size of your plate. It's what the person's doing next to you. It's what you're listening to when you're eating.
It's so hard to imagine that walking 6 feet, which is nothing, no effort at all, would make such a big change.
Well, it's crazy, but what we do when we ask people, we say, hey, do you realize that you, instead of eating I guess it was 9 candies, they only ate 4 candies. If it's 6 feet away, we'd say, is that 6 feet? Is it too far to walk? People would go, no, it's not too far to walk. It's just that 6 feet gives me pause to say, hey, am I really that hungry? That's the reason that for 70% of the people, 100 calorie packs work, because that the end of that package gives you pause to say, geez, do I really want a second one or a fifth one?
Right. Well, let's talk about your lab, and we'll get into more of the research because you've done such fascinating studies. But tell me a little bit about the Food and Brand Lab, where you work. How have you designed this?
Well, it's really cool. I mean, when you think of labs, you think of like crazy-haired professors in lab coats who like look like Einstein, and there's beakers, and there's like somebody with like bolts in their neck over on a slab. But this lab is a behavioral lab, so it looks almost like your home. That is, if your home had one-way mirrors, and if your home had hidden cameras, if your home had hidden scales in the table. But within about 3 hours, we can transform this lab to look like this room, this series of rooms, rather, to look like any place you can imagine. We can make it look like a restaurant. We can make it look like a living room or a bedroom or a dining room or a bar. We've even done studies where we made the inside of it look like the inside of a tank by bringing in paper and stuff, because we were studying something for the U.S. Military about how to get people to eat better when they're in vehicles. And what we do is we bring people in and we change something. We might change the lighting, or we might change how people sit, or we might change how far away a serving bowl is. And we find simply by doing these things, we can determine how it would influence people in real life.
How do you come up with the ideas for what you will test in the lab? Because some of the changes that you've made are so minute but have such a big impact. And I was reading your book and I kept thinking, how did he even think to test that?
Oh. And I guess one of the beauties of spending summers on a farm is you have to get really creative, I guess. Well, I think one of the things we have done is we've taken and put hidden cameras in homes. Now, these aren't hidden cameras that people don't know are there, but they're cameras where people say, yeah, you can put a motion-activated camera in my kitchen or dining room or whatever the case is. And what we do is we'll just watch footage of what people do, and we'll say, huh, now why do you think they did that versus that? Huh, now why do you think they put the serving bowl so far this time where usually it's right in front of them? Why do you think, and essentially by asking that, what do you think, why do you think, why this time versus that time, there's a genesis for a lot of ideas. And simply like a lot of the stuff with dishes and stuff, we've found, we'd say, why is that person using a different dish today than yesterday? Do you think dishes make any difference? And you kind of go, God, who would have thought of that? And so we test it.
And you've discovered that basically the questions that you ask people about their food behaviors have no basis in reality. People cannot tell you why they do what they do.
Yeah, it's amazing. You can take your smartest friend, the friend who knows everything about politics and world history. They know like the state, they know the country capitals of like some of the countries that used to be in Russia. I mean, they know everything. But if you say, hey, why did you have a turkey sandwich today and a hamburger yesterday for lunch? They'll go, and you might be able to mutter out some semi-intelligent sounding justification, but it basically comes down to, I don't know, or I liked it, or I felt like it. And so here you have the smartest friend you have who cannot articulate why they chose what they chose for lunch or for breakfast. And that's neat, because then you're looking at changes that can make a big difference in a person's health that clearly they're not even aware of.
Let's talk about one of the most interesting things that I think you've found, and that is that we have no idea when we're full. We mm-hmm. seem to have mm-hmm. absolutely no gauge for that. And and you've proven that in several different ways. And one of the ways that you did that was with a bottomless bowl of soup. Can you describe that experiment?
Yeah, that's true. So I was living in France at one point, and I asked 150 sophisticated Parisians, how do you know when you're through eating dinner? Okay, and the number one answer was, I know I'm through eating dinner when I'm no longer hungry or when the food no longer tastes good, which they're using internal cues to say, stop. I got back about 3 or 4 months later and asked the same question of 150 Chicagoans. And the Chicagoans said, I know I'm through eating dinner when my plate is empty. So the second most common answer was when the TV show I'm watching is over, okay? Which are both external cues
right. To
stop. Well, it made us wonder, what would happen if your plate never emptied, your bowl never emptied? Would we just continue to eat like, you know, the family dog till we exploded? And so we developed this study where we took the soup bowls, drilled holes in the bottom of bowls, drilled holes through tables in a restaurant that had agreed to let us do this, and then hooked these tubes, this food-grade tubing, up to these big six-quart vats of soup, brought people in and either ate from those bowls or from normal bowls, and we found that when people sit down and eat from a bottomless bowl, they end up eating about 72% more in just 10 minutes, 72% more soup. But if you ask them if they're full, they go, no, how could I be full? I mean, I still have half a bowl of soup left.
So eating this enormous quantity, right. And even one of the people ate just a remarkable quantity.
Like
of
over
soup.
Five people ate over a quart in 10 minutes.
Wow.
Well, there's another study that I allude to just briefly in my book, Mindless Eating, and that's one where we did it with chicken wings. And and this was done over in not far away in Champaign, Illinois. There's a sports bar called Jillian's, and I don't know if there might be any in Iowa, but we brought people in, and it was like free chicken wing night or I don't know, something like that. And what we did is we worked with the waitresses to bus only half the tables. So half the tables would have if they finished their chicken wings, they'd have them bussed, and then they could get more. And the other half, we just let them, the chicken wings sort of
pile up on the table, right?
Kind of reminders of just really how much you'd eaten. And one of the things we found is that if you bust people's bones, they end up eating about 30% more, which isn't surprising because you forget how much you've eaten because we eat with our eyes and not our stomach. But what was interesting is that at the end of the night, when we went to people and said, hey, there's these new skillet cookies. I mean, they have like, I don't know, 17,000 calories a piece or something. We have these new skillet cookies. Did you want one? It's free. It's complimentary. If people had their bones sitting on the table and they pretty much knew how much they ate, only about a quarter of them took the cookie.
Wow.
If people had the bones bust, pretty much every one of these people, about 90%, would say, you know, bring it on. You know, and we're seeing, they're eating it on the way to the parking lot.
we will continue our conversation in just a moment. I'm talking to Brian Wansing. He's the director of the Food and Brand Lab at Cornell University and the author of the book Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. We've put up a link to his website on our Facebook page at Iowa Public Radio. It's mindlesseating.org. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest today is Brian Wansink. He is the author of the book Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. He's also the director of the Food and Brand Lab at Cornell University. We were talking about the fact that we don't have this internal idea of when we're full, and we all think that we do. So when you ask people after you set up an experiment, when you ask them to talk about, you know, why they ate what they ate, they'll probably say, well, I ate until I was full.
Yeah, well, exactly. There's something called the intelligence trap. And it basically holds that most pretty smart people can justify anything they do. They can justify anything they want to do. They can come up with 15 reasons why it was a brilliant idea. And even in these cases where we'll, for instance, change the size of a popcorn bucket we give people in the movies, and we'll give them like 5-day-old, terrible, stale, nasty popcorn, and they still end up eating about 35% more of this terrible popcorn. And when they leave, we say, hey, you know, you ate about 35% more than people with a slightly smaller bucket. Was it because the popcorn was good? They go, no, it was terrible. Was it because you're hungry? It's like, no, I just ate dinner. Well, do you think it could have been because the bucket was bigger? And to a person, they'll go, no, 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 no. And they'll try to give you some reason. It's just clear they're just grasping for straws.
Well, and you have shown that with you've hosted parties where you've changed the size of the bowl that you are serving people in, and that makes a huge impact.
It's just amazing that even changing just the size of a serving bowl ends up bumping up how much people serve. In a series of Super Bowl parties we did, which were actually published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, we found that people ended up taking more Chex Mix, 44% more Chex Mix, if they just took it from a slightly larger bowl. I mean, there's great news you can use here if you're a party host or a parent who doesn't want people to overeat. Is just put the food in a slightly smaller bowl. Even if it's the same amount of food, if you put it in a slightly smaller bowl, what it suggests is that there's a smaller consumption norm, that it's typical, reasonable, and appropriate to take a little less, and you justifiably do. I mean, we've done the same thing with plate sizes, and we've shown that you'll serve about 22% more pasta on a 12-inch plate, which is what most of us have in our cupboards, than you will a 10-inch plate, because you'll put about 4 ounces of pasta on your 10-inch plate. But if you put the same 4 ounces on a 12-inch plate, geez, it doesn't even look like an appetizer. So what do? You put on another scoop. But what we find is that people have no awareness of having eaten more because in their mind, hey, they had a full plate of pasta.
You also do studies about variety. And this was fascinating to me, too, when you gave people different kinds of candies in different ways, jelly beans and M&Ms. And so you separated out the jelly beans in one of the experiments. So people would take them from separate little cups, or you gave them an option to take jelly beans out of a bowl of mixed jelly beans. What was the difference?
What ends up happening is that people end up eating so much more if they think there's a lot of variety. But there doesn't even have to be more variety. It just has to look like there's more. So, for instance, we'll have parties and let's say we'll serve three things. We'll serve, let's say, Chex Mix, M&Ms, and maybe mixed nuts. If we have them in three bowls on the table, people will take some. If we divide those three bowls into nine bowls, so it's still three things, but they're just in three bowls each, the next day when we ask people, hey, what'd you think of the party? That's great. We have them fill out a questionnaire. What do you think about the variety of food? People would go, oh, man, there's a lot of variety, a lot of variety. That's the same three things. They're just in more bowls. And we find that people, on average, per person, ended up eating about 16% more. If you just think there's more stuff, you eat more.
Well, and even you gave them bowls of mixed M&Ms, and in one bowl there was more color, different colors than in the other bowl. So it was like the same presentation, and that changed how people eat.
That's right. Everybody knows M&Ms taste the same regardless of whether they're – yellow or green.
Everyone knows that. Yes, go on.
Okay. Everybody over the age of seven. people ended up eating almost 50% more M&Ms if you divide them up. But, the thing is, with all these things, that there's news you can use for every one of these studies I talk about, for every one of these findings, there's real easy things that can be done to help you mindlessly eat less rather than mindlessly overeat.
Well, and that's a really interesting phrase, and you use that quite a lot in the book. But when I picked up the book, I thought, okay, this is about mindless eating, so he's going to want us to be mindful of what we're eating, and that is not your approach.
No. I mean, a lot of people say, okay, mindless eating, bad. So the secret solution to mindless eating is to be mindful. It's like, no way. I mean, who has the time to sort of cut a raisin in half and taste the raisin and roll it around your mouth and talk about how it was grown? Most people don't. If you do, that's great because you'll enjoy eating food a lot more. But most of us don't have the luxury of doing that because we're coming home from a stressed out day. We have a to-do list of about 30 things on it for that night. The kids are screaming and the mail's scattered across the kitchen. To eat the raisin and go, it's just not realistic for most people. So instead, I think the solution to mindless eating is essentially setting up your kitchen or your home or your habits so you can mindlessly eat less without having to think about it. I mean, if using a smaller plate or a smaller bowl causes you to serve and eat 22% less.
Well, without even thinking about
it. Yeah. don't just keep the big one and say, well, now that I know it, it shan't affect me. It assuredly will.
If you'd like to join our conversation, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm talking with Brian Wansink. He's the director of the Food and Brand Lab at Cornell University and the author of the book Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. And you mentioned 22%, and that's one of the recommendations that you have, is that we should try to eat about 20% less food.
Yeah, and it's great, because at that point we still feel full, but we don't feel stuffed. But there's a lot of ways to do that in a very sort of mindless way.
Right. I was going to say, I mean, if I have to think I'm going to eat 20% less food, that doesn't sound like something I would be very successful at.
No, you just want to set things up that naturally you do that. So, for instance, there's five areas that can trip a person up. Not all five of these areas vex everyone equally, but meal stuffing is one of them, snack grazing is another one, and so on. But if we look at meal stuffing, using that smaller plate, all of a sudden, you know, even if you go back for seconds and thirds, as long as the plate's not too small, it's got to be above about 9.5 inches or so. But as long as it's not too small, it'll cut down how much you eat. Similarly, if you are a guy, and a lot of guys have the problem that, you know, they pretty much inhale food, and the rest of their family, like, eats in slow motion. So after they're finished eating, they just sit there and watch everybody else eat. No, they don't. What they do is they put on seconds and thirds and fourths till everybody's finished. And a really easy solution for guys, we found that ends up cutting down about 30% of how much they end up serving, is if you take the serving bowls and move them over to a counter, instead of serving off the table, you serve off the stove. You have the pasta in the stove, or, you know, the meat on the counter or whatever.
So again, he would have to get up and walk 6 feet.
Exactly.
And we're not going to do that.
Yeah. Now that works. It only cuts down how much women eat by about 9%. But for guys, it's about 29%. Because for a lot of guys who have problems with overeating at mealtime, it's just because we have seconds, thirds, and fourths.
Fascinating. Well, and one of the studies that you did showed that there is a certain idea of manliness that's associated with not just with cleaning your plate, but with finishing even a snack. You did this. This was about popcorn, and men considered themselves and other men to be more manly if they ate all their popcorn.
That's right. That's right. It's kind of funny, too, because in one of these things, we would see what people would do if they were on dates and stuff, and guys tend to eat more than they typically would if they were by themselves. But then we also gave them these little scenarios. This is kind of funny. We'd give them scenarios where Brad was on a date with Janet, and they would be doing something, and Brad either like ate all the popcorn or he didn't, but everything else in the date was exactly the same. And when we asked people to rate how manly Brad was, or how masculine, they rated him a lot higher if he had eaten all of his popcorn.
But the men rated him higher.
Oh, the men did. Yeah, that's right. Right. That's right. Only the men did. That's right.
And the women didn't care at all.
Yeah, and then we asked this really stupid question. We asked him, how much do you think Brad could bench press? And if he had finished all his popcorn, they just assumed he's, you know, hey, this is a real man. You know, it's pretty geeky.
That's so fascinating. So that is not a measure of manliness to finish all your popcorn?
Well, apparently not to women, but I think to men it is, yeah.
All right. We have a lot of callers on the line who want to get in on this conversation. Lauren is on the line from Des Moines. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, good morning. I wanted to thank you for bringing our attention to, you know, the mindfulness of eating, because it's an everyday habit. So, you know, if we're not paying attention to that, what else are we not paying attention to in our lives? I'm a meditation practitioner, and I participated in a 30-day retreat last year. And what they had us do was eat out of Oreoke style, like monastic style eating, which it's like three little bowls, and you have to serve each other and eat everything like oatmeal with chopsticks. Soup with chopsticks. And we did this three meals a day for a whole month. And at the beginning of the retreat, I was freaking out because I didn't think I was getting enough food. And so I would just stuff myself. Like I would just like keep, you know, pouring the food down my throat and then, you know, hand out the bowl for somebody else to serve me again. And it became a race because, you know, everything was done in silence. So they were clacking and ringing bells to kind of cue us when to serve one another. And at a certain point, I was, like, gaining weight, and I said, this is stupid. You know, what am I doing here? So there was just a neurosis about not having enough and that the bowls were too small.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, by the end of the retreat, I was really tasting food in a whole different light. And, you know, I've maintained pretty good eating habits after the fact. So, like I said, I just want to share that. And,
do you still eat out of small bowls, Lauren?
I wish I could, but, you know, my family's really not into that, you know. It's like a whole practice of its own.
Oh, Lauren, yeah. thanks a lot for your call. And it sounds like it was an exercise to make them think about eating more. But, again, it goes back to that basic principle. If you're eating off of a smaller surface, you're going to eat less.
Yeah, and it takes a while to reset that norm. And I think what you're responding to earlier in your retreat, Lauren, was the fact that the visual norm you had sort of imprinted in your mind was a much larger one. And it takes a while to reset that. But I'm glad that it gave you a greater appreciation for food, because that's the one of the best, most practical reasons, to do mindful eating, is that it really brings you back to enjoying the taste of food.
Well, and she mentioned chopsticks, and you write about chopsticks and how people use chopsticks at Chinese restaurants, and sort of the differences in the people who use chopsticks. What do chopsticks do for us?
Well, it's interesting. One of the things we did this study with about 300 people across the United States, and we looked at what do skinny people do in Chinese buffets that heavy people don't do? Because clearly, I mean, you could say, well, they probably eat less, but are there other behaviors? And some of the behaviors that were kind of neat was, one is we found that they're much more likely, about three times more likely to use chopsticks than forks. But another thing we found is that they, on average, they sit about 16 feet farther away from the buffet. They're also about three times as likely to sit facing away from the food, whereas heavier people will almost always sit facing the food, which is terrible, because this is an ongoing reminder that food. But the crazy thing about this, there's a ton of things, but one of the other things that was interesting is how people serve themselves, and that the skinny, heavy people tended to go and pick the plate up and then look at the first item and say, do I want it or not? And the second item say, do I want it or not? And skinnier people just tended to kind of get up and walk around the buffet before even picking up a plate. But the crazy thing about this is afterwards we'd talk to people and we'd intercept them when they're out in the parking lot and say, hey, why did you do X, Y, and Z? And they go, really? I did that? People are totally unaware that these things influence them. And that's what makes this stuff so powerful.
That's fascinating. And how about drinks? I mean, when you watch people and their behavior in restaurants, how does what they drink with their meal affect their behavior?
You know, it's interesting. We've only done a few different things related to drinks. But one of the things we do is what we call a trigger food, although it's a beverage, we call it a trigger beverage, I guess. But it tends to be a trigger. So what we'll find is that people who order a sweet drink end up being more likely to eat sweeter foods after that. People who drink milk end up eating the healthiest, milk and water. So it's almost whatever you're drinking sort of cues things. People who drink beer tend to then buy different things. Now that is just correlational stuff that we've observed, but the beverage you choose seems to be related to actually what you have after that.
Interesting. Well, and you did a study about wine, and I want to ask about this, because you bought a bunch of Two-Buck Chuck, and you relabeled
that's funny.
In two different ways. And you labeled some of the bottles of wine saying that they were a new kind of wine from a winery in California. The other bottles you labeled a new kind of wine from a winery in North Dakota.
The 50th state in the nation to commercially produce wine, yeah. You know, we have a research restaurant called the Spice Box, and people come in and they eat. It's usually about $20-25 every Thursday night when they come in. And we did the study, and then we went up and we said, hey, and this was in Illinois, you know, snowy February. We said, hey, thanks for keeping reservation. It's a thanks. Here's a free glass of Cabernet from California. Or for the other tables, we'd say it's from North Dakota. If people thought they're drinking California wine, or let's say if they thought they're drinking something that wasn't very good, North Dakota wine, it ruined the entire meal. It's like the first experience of that night had this negative cloud over everything else. So what we found is if they thought they're drinking North Dakota wine, they ate faster and just got out of the restaurant. They rated the wine as worse, but they also rated the food as worse. Now, it's the exact same wine, okay? They rated the wine as worse. They rated the food as worse. And It's interesting. Afterwards, when people were leaving, we asked them if they wanted to kind of make reservations to come back. And if they were given California wine, people would kind of go, yeah, and they'd make a lot of them would make reservations to come back. If they had drank North Dakota wine, even though it's free, they'd go, oh, no, no. In fact, one guy even said, I'm really busy for the rest of my life.
And who ate more? The people who drank the North Dakota wine or who drank the
California?
Well, the
people who ate the California wine, you know, ended up finishing more of the food. They liked it more. I think it's partly because they sat longer and they rated the food as better.
They enjoyed their evening a lot more.
Yeah, but it's interesting. Which group do you think drank the most wine?
Well, I've read it. They both finished their wine. Who doesn't drink a free glass of wine? We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. I'm talking with Brian Wansing. He is the director of the Food and Brand Lab at Cornell University. He's the author of the book Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think.
I'm Charity Nebbe, and you're listening to an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest today is Brian Wansing. He is the author of the book Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think, and the director of the Food and Brand Lab at Cornell University. And he knows a whole lot about you and why you behave the way that you do. And you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And next up is Tom on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. Hey, my question is, I've seen situations more than once where a host will have guests there and will just pile food on the plate. And I'm guessing the reasoning behind that is to show how much you love somebody or care about them, so you give them a whole lot more food than they really want or can eat. And I think that's part of the problem with our weight gain in this country, is that people are overly generous to their guests.
Well, that is an interesting point, Tom. And you've done a lot of research about how the company that you have at a meal affects how much you eat. And it affects you in some really surprising ways.
Dramatically. If you eat with one other person, you'll eat 30% more than you'll eat if you eat by yourself. If you eat with seven or more other people, you eat almost 90% more, largely because it extends the experience. But Tom, you bring up an interesting point because you say, what can I do in a situation like that? Well, typically, in most dinner situations, people aren't necessarily serving you unless it's coming pre-plated from the kitchen. It's often it's on the, you know, whether it be a Thanksgiving at your aunt's place or whether it be, you know, a holiday dinner. It's usually the stuff's in the middle of the table. You can put whatever you want on. But we ourselves feel pressured sometimes to, I think, overeat because we want to show, you know, Aunt Grace that we really appreciate all the work she put into things. But there's a pretty easy way to do it because one of the things we find is that the day after these kind of semi-stressful meals for the person who's preparing them, they don't remember quantities. But they don't remember whether you took a little or a lot. But what they do is they remember that you asked for seconds or you asked for thirds. And so simply serving yourself a very small amount of whatever, stuffing or mashed potatoes or whatever, but announcing every time you serve yourself seconds is going to register with your Aunt Grace that, wow, you really appreciate what she did for you and you're not going to overeat.
So you just say, I'm going to have more of that. Oh, and Aunt it doesn't
Grace
even matter if you,
this
you
is
eat it.
Yeah, this is the greatest stuffing. I mean, it is every year. It's exact same. But so good, I'm going to have seconds. And she's not going to remember that it was in teaspoonful you took the first time and a teaspoonful you took the second time. She's just going to remember that you're the person who asked for seconds.
When you eat with people that you really enjoy their company, that influences how much you eat as well.
Oh, tremendously, because usually we don't eat with people we don't like. We eat with people that we like. And if you're out for at a restaurant, you're eating at home with somebody you like, you almost want to extend the experience. So what it does is it leads you to, you know, maybe have that extra dinner roll or maybe order a dessert together or order an extra coffee or something. And it ends up being a difficult thing to get around. And in mindless eating, we talk about one study we did called the restaurant rule of two, that to say, okay, well, then the solution is never to eat with friends. No, no, no. Instead, what you want to do is just put some governor, some limit on how much you eat. But it's got to be natural. So one thing we do is we say, look, order anything you want to for your entree, but only have two additional items. It could be a piece of bread, an appetizer. It could be a glass of wine and a dessert. But don't have everything. You can't have two pieces of bread and a dessert. And the nice thing about this is people can get what they really want. They don't feel put out. But then also you can stay there for 3 hours and not blow up like the family dog.
But, you know, obviously that's just something that you're aware of, too, that it doesn't mean that you shouldn't socialize with people. But you know that when you socialize with people, this is something that's probably going to happen.
Yeah, and it's important to realize that this happens, but you don't want to be that person. And that person is the person who kind of says, boy, I really shouldn't because I'm on a date. You know, boy, I'm on a diet. Boy, I really shouldn't because I'm on a diet. And because you kind of ruin the experience for everybody else. So the thing is, just set things up so you have fun, you order what you want, but you don't overeat because you've given yourself a limit to how many extras, because it's the extras that kill us.
Jay is on the line in Moline, Illinois. Hi, Jay.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
What would you like to talk about?
Well, I'd like to bring up some of the things that your guest is speaking about. First off, I'd just like to describe myself quickly.
We don't have a lot of time, Jay, so very quickly.
Very quickly. I'm an active person, and I stand where I work, so I'm an active person all day long. My typical breakfast used to be cereal with some milk, you know, a bagel or English muffin with some jam on it, a couple cups of coffee with sugar in it. Come lunchtime, I had cravings for more food, real cravings that I could not ignore. So I go out and, you know, grab a burger, some French fries, but I've changed all that kind of eating. For example, my breakfast now, I'll have eggs, I'll throw some cheese on it, and no bagels, no English muffins. And come lunchtime, I'm not hungry. I have no cravings. I don't go for that burger. I don't go for the fries. I've cut out fries. I've cut out whole wheat. And I've cut out carbs. So what you're talking about, I feel, is somewhat gimmicky. It's entertaining, but it's not helpful for people who have cravings, who at some point in the day feel they need more food because those cravings are the result of what they had for breakfast.
Yeah, Jay. Yeah, and you did the perfect thing. We've heard this from a number of people that switching things over to hot protein for breakfast has a miraculous effect on a lot of people, because what it does is the protein burns longer. It doesn't burn off instantly like the carbohydrates that you mentioned. And so what it does is it sates throughout the whole morning. In fact, this ends up being one of the interventions that we'll work with for people who end up having these problems of sort of snacking before noontime. Is we say, here's something to try. It's either protein or, more importantly, it's hot protein. Now, the reason that's hot, we don't think that makes any sort of physiological difference. What that makes is a psychological difference, because you feel like you had a real meal, not just some sort of carby snack. Thanks. Very good comments, Jay.
Well, and you do write about typical diets, traditional diets, and why many of them don't work and why some of them have lost their efficacy. I mean, one of the things that you point out is, of course, if we really limit our calories, then our bodies go into conservation mode. So it's very difficult to continue losing weight, and it's very easy to put the weight back on, which is something we've talked about on this program before. But you also write about those diets that work for a while, like the grapefruit diet, the cabbage soup diet, the Atkins diet, where you're really limiting the kinds of food that you can eat, and that really cuts down on what you eat because you're sick of it. You write about the fact that the Atkins diet isn't as effective anymore because it got to be so popular. Why is that?
Well, what happened is that it just ended up focusing on don't eating carbohydrates. So as a result, what a lot of companies did is they reformulated things so that they fit the Atkins sort of criteria of being an edible food. But what they did in doing so is they introduced a lot of variety that people could eat. Because if initially you say you can't eat carbohydrates, people would say, geez, you know, I'm stuck with vegetables and meat and fat. That's going to get boring real fast. But all of a sudden, if there's a carb-free cracker or whatever that comes up, all of a sudden, what got you to lose weight in the first place, which is the lack of variety, has all of a sudden been introduced back into the diet in the form of, you know, legal variety, but variety that I think he didn't initially intend to be there.
So, and the variety means that you don't get sick of eating the food and the diet doesn't work as well. But for a long-term change, you say that losing about a half a pound a week is something your body won't freak out and go into conservation mode, and it makes a huge impact over time. But that's so frustrating if you want to lose weight. That's not very fast.
No, you're right. It's not very fast. And I think what people sort of need to realize, and we get lots of letters and emails and stuff from people, they'll say, you'll never guess how much weight I've lost over the last year. It'll be like 22 pounds, okay, which isn't a huge amount, you know, for some people. But they said, but I didn't have to do anything other than, you know, I only eat at a table, or, you know, I never have a snack unless I have a piece of fruit before, and things like that. Real easy changes that didn't alter their life. And people need to realize that we gain weight at, you know, 100 calories a day. We don't gain it 22 pounds a day. So it's kind of hard to expect to lose it 22 pounds, you know, before next week's high school reunion.
Right. So the amount of weight loss that you can achieve by changing your behavior in small ways is more sustainable too. So if you have changed 100 calories a day and you lose a significant amount of weight over a period of a year, you're also more likely to keep that off.
Yeah, because it's the result of a new habit, right? But a lot of people that go on these drastic deprivation diets where maybe they're losing a pound or even more a week, it's just not really sustainable because you're not changing your habits. What you're doing is you're just, you know, essentially holding your breath till you've lost enough. And then when you have to start breathing again, you're going to go back to your natural tendencies.
So once we understand why we eat what we eat, that doesn't change the environment that we're entering into every day. So once somebody gathers all of this information, what do you want them to do with it? How can you use this information to change your habits?
Well, that's the whole purpose of chapter 10 in mindless eating, because, you know, we may not be able to change what's in the grocery store, okay? We may not be able to change what's in a restaurant, but what we can do is we can come up with a rule of thumb, an easy rule of thumb in a restaurant, to just not eat more than two things other than the entree. Where we can change everything, so we can change everything in our kitchen. We can essentially do a kitchen makeover, if you would. We can redesign our tablescape with smaller plates, smaller serving bowls, put the serving bowls back on the table. So there's a lot of things that we could just do today that can make a huge dent in things.
And how do you know if you've done enough?
Well, I mean, there's...
Because you don't
really
want us to
way.
Spend all of our time thinking about this.
No. And, you know, we find the easiest way to do things is not to track your weight, because weight fluctuates for a bunch of different reasons. That's really discouraging to do that. But it's a lot easier to just track behavior. And actually, on the website mindlesseating.org, there's a sheet. It's a calendar that you can just download. Now, what we recommend that people do if they're really interested in tracking, not everybody is. Most people just want to do it and forget about it. If you're interested in tracking, you come up with just maybe one change you want to make, and each day you do it, you just put a little check on the calendar. And so what you're rewarding yourself for is the behavior. You're rewarding yourself for serving off of the counter or the stove. You're not rewarding yourself for losing a quarter of a pound. And that's something we have control over, is our behavior.
And as a student of human behavior, how long does it take for a new change to become a habit, something you can sustain?
Hey, so this is really cool. I mean, they often say that it's, you know, 28 days. You know, it's not very validly shown, but it takes a good solid month. But we did this really cool study, and this is under review now. I think it's going to make a splash. But we found that when it comes to – when we give people tips and we ask them to follow tips, that, you know, on a weight loss a person loses kind of goes up the number of days that month they do the tip. But something really magical happens at about the age of at the 25th day, that once they've done it 25 days or more during the month, it has this incredible impact on weight loss. And we think that's not only the point where it starts becoming a habit, but that's also the point where they start enlisting other changes. And so there's a real magic to just getting past this 25-day hump.
We talked earlier about the fact that you think people should generally shoot for trying to eat about 20% less. You also say that we should try to eat about 20% more fruits and vegetables. When you make that kind of change, what kinds of results should you see? I mean, how do you know that that's working for you?
You know, with the fruits and vegetables, it's, you know, I think a dietitian would say, well, you'll feel better this way or this way. We don't get a lot of evidence that people feel different if they eat more fruits and vegetables. What we find is that they can feel full and gain less weight. But from a feeling standpoint, it doesn't seem to make a person feel lighter or happier or whatever. But with the eating a little bit less, when we've tracked people, the big advantage that comes there is people don't rate themselves. They rate themselves as having more energy half an hour after the meal and then 3 hours after the meal. So
it does change how you feel.
We've just done this for lunch and dinners. Yeah. But what it does is it makes you feel more energetic and less tired. It's kind of like after Thanksgiving dinner, all you want to do is sleep, right? You have a little bit less. You don't want to sleep. You want to...
And when you recommend that people eat a little bit less, you are not recommending that we give up our favorite things, our indulgences.
Yeah, no, because I think once we do that, then something happens and it's something called compensation, is we compensate by doing something else. If what we really love is ice cream, we say, I'm never going to eat ice cream or pizza again in my life, which happens every New Year's Eve, or, you know,
right,
for most people's resolutions. It only happens for a short period of time to begin with. But second, you compensate then by eating a lot of onion rings or whatever else might be your Achilles heel.
Right. Your third level weakness.
Yeah, right, yeah,
or
that's right.
Like
that's
that.
Right. Because you're compensating for having foregone something you really, really like. So what you do is you reward yourself.
And it was your research largely that introduced these 100 calorie packs,
yeah,
that we see of so many different kinds of things. So that's a good strategy from your perspective?
Yeah, it works. Actually, when we developed this in about 1995, we found that about 70% of the population who we gave these things to ended up eating less. 30% ate the same amount or slightly more, but enough
ate two or three packs.
Yeah, that's right. But we actually then took this, at that time I was a professor at the Wharton School in the University of Pennsylvania, and I took it to Nabisco and M&M Mars and Kellogg's and said, look, here's a way you can help people eat less and you can make more money. And it took a while, but eventually things got traction.
So we have just a minute left, but when you look around the world today, and obviously we have an obesity epidemic, we're in trouble. What do you see as the number one thing that you would love to see change in our environment?
For people to realize that they are the nutritional gatekeeper of their home, that whoever purchases and prepares most of the food in their family influences about 72% of what their family eats and how much they eat, either for the better or for the worse. And to realize that the changes they can make are ones in their home tonight, I think would move us in such a big direction, other than trying to point fingers elsewhere and hoping things change and we instantly become skinny.
Brian Wansink, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Charity.
Brian Wansink is the author of the book Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. He is a guest of the University of Iowa Obesity Initiative. That's what he's doing here in Iowa City today, and he'll be in Ames tomorrow night giving a public lecture in the Memorial Union at 8 o'clock. And you can find a link to his website on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Lindsay Moon. You can podcast the program at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe, and this is an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.